You're listening to the Enhance Your Practice podcast series brought to you by ASPS University. I'm Dr. Renee Burke, ASPS University Dean of Practice Management, and I invite you to check out all of our educational offerings, from professional surgical videos, courses on practice management, and much more on ASPS EdNet.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of ASPS University podcast. I am thrilled to be your host for tonight's episode, which is Ethics in Social Media. I have two outstanding guests with me, people that I am very humbled and honored to be presenting with, moderating with tonight. The first is Dr. Anu Bajaj, and she is in solo private practice in Oklahoma City. She's the past chair of the Ethics Committee for ASPS and past member of the Social Media Task Force of ASPS. Now, it was a task force that was formed to discuss and evaluate the ethical use of social media and plastic surgery. She writes for the ethics column and ethical matter for the Plastic Surgery News. My other guest is Dr. Christian Berkler, a professor of plastic surgery at the University of Michigan, chief of clinical ethics at the Center for Bioethics and Social Sciences and Medicine at the University of Michigan, and the current chair of the ASPS Ethics Committee. I've known Christian for over, probably about close to 20 years. We trained at Emory together, where he went and got his master's in bioethics when a lot of people were off working in the research labs. So I have two world-class experts. I'm so excited because this is such a hot topic. And I think my first question that I'll throw out there, because we all have this feeling of we sort of know what ethics means, but can you guys sort of define better how you view the role of ethics in social media, particularly for a plastic surgeon?
Renee, to answer your question regarding the role for ethics in plastic surgery, the way I think about things as I approach how I want to deal with social media is social media for plastic surgery has become a way for us to market. But while we're marketing and selling ourselves, we also have to, we have a role to educate the public. And I think what we post should be educational and fun, and at the same time have respect for our colleagues and our patients and others who view our different social media channels. And that's fundamental to me, is to always show respect for everybody.
And Dr. Berkler, how do you answer, what's the importance of ethics?
Well, so I think it's very interesting that as plastic surgeons, we're physicians first and foremost. And as physicians, we're members of the profession of being physicians. And the thing about being a member of a profession is that professions are marked by several different attributes that make it a profession. So the first is that we have, you know, a specialized knowledge that other people don't have. The other is that we regulate ourselves and that we hold ourselves to a higher standard. And so really it's that the code of ethics, and for us plastic surgeons is the ASPS code of ethics. It's sort of having that high standard that we hold each other accountable to. And so every member of the ASPS sort of says that they will uphold the dignity and honor of the profession and accept its self-imposed disciplines. And it's that idea of self-discipline and self-regulation that is part of that hallmark of a profession. So the fact that we kind of can call ourselves plastic surgeons and as board-certified plastic surgeons who are members of the ASPS, with that comes this idea that we hold ourselves accountable to a higher standard than we hold the average citizen. And so kind of knowing ethics and talking about it and sort of using these ideas as our guidelines for how we take care of our patients and how we treat one another, I think is just fundamental.
And so both of you having served, either served on or currently serving on the Ethics Committee, I think it becomes, sometimes things get a little muddied, the waters, when we know, for example, when there's a HIPAA violation. But what about when you're looking at social media and something just seems like an ethical violation? You know, you see these videos of, you know, patients, or you hear the stories, someone who died in the OR when there was a doctor dancing there or something of that nature. Obviously, that's unethical. But then sometimes the lines get a little muddy. Like, how do you go about kind of giving guidance, especially for, say, a newer plastic surgeon who's just starting up and trying to get their social media presence out there?
Well, I think one thing to remember is most of what has been created, whether it's the Code of Ethics for ASPS, whether it's the Code of Ethics for the American Board of Plastic Surgery, or it's the principles highlighted by the Federation of State Medical Boards, there are always these general guiding principles that guide our professional behavior. And those guiding principles are based on respect for our patients and colleagues, the concept of not doing harm, and the concept of doing good for society. And I think when we get into situations where we have surgeons or physicians dancing in the OR or holding up specimens and mocking the patient, we're violating those professional principles. And while they're not clear-cut legal violations, they reflect poorly on the profession as a whole. And so they are ethical violations because of that.
And Christian, your thoughts?
Yeah, the way that the ASPS Ethics Committee works is that, you know, it's a group of your peers that can investigate the proposed ethical violations. So if you see, you know, any member, you know, part of being a member of the ASPS, in fact, it's in the Code of Ethics, it says that we should expose without hesitation any unethical conduct of fellow members. And so I may regret saying this because I'm the one who has to answer the question or, you know, to investigate these when people report them. But if you see something that looks like unethical content, you know, this is the path that you have. This is the recourse that you have. And you say, this is embarrassing to me as a member of this profession. This seems to be unethical content. You can report that to the ASPS. It can even be reported anonymously, although we always protect the identity of people who report either way, even if you do identify yourself. And then we investigate that, and we look at our code of ethics, and we, you know, try to hold members accountable for their actions when they do behave unethically. And I think we have a very fair process that we go through. But I think that's the recourse for that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's important for people to know, because while I think the majority of the people listening to this are probably plastic surgeons, I think there's a lot of people listening that are not as well. And people may or may not realize that we do have standards we have to uphold ourselves to that should be above and beyond that of the general public.
Renee, can I recount a story that I think may allude to a little bit about the gray area you were asking about?
I'd love to hear it, yeah.
So I think 3 or 4 years ago, one of our members, who we all know very well and is involved in leadership and practices in a larger city, posted something on social media. It was a woman in thong underwear after having obtained a Brazilian butt lift, and he was looking at her suggestively, and it was a practice promotional photo. So it's presumed that it was a physician and patient. And to me, as a woman and as a female plastic surgeon, I found it distasteful, just the way he was looking at her, and it was the buttock of her and her thongs. And actually what ended up happening is the surgeon and I had a conversation regarding, well, I'm in the Midwest. Maybe things are more acceptable on the coast in a larger city than here. But I said enough people that I shared this image with did feel it was more of a sexual type of photo that he did take it down. And so while that isn't a clear ethical violation per se per the Code of Ethics, it's something that may not reflect well on all plastic surgeons. And we have to be cognizant that as people post on social media, geographic and societal or cultural norms may vary.
Yeah, I think that one of the hard things too, and I mean, I'm in private practice, I'm in solo practice, and we are always flooded with how important it is to have a social media presence. But, you know, really is always making sure you're doing it, how to ethically interact with your patient. I mean, really, what are the guidelines, you know, to follow? For example, if somebody is filming in the operating room, you know, I mean, per the Code of Ethics, I mean, are there any hard, fast rules that you guys, you know, can think of that really stand out?
Well, I would say that the general principle is to never, I mean, this is a general philosophical principle, is never use people merely as means to an end and always respect their inherent dignity. And so it's in the way, that's the general principle. Within the code of ethics, it says that members shall always strive to use accurate and respectful language and images in all of their public and private communications. And so that's the line in the code that if someone asks us about it and they say, well, does this reflect respectful language and images? And so that's kind of what we do. I mean, it may sound vague, but to be respectful to our patients, one of the ways that you can do that, you know, how does that, you know, play out is getting consent for the use of patient images. And, you know, it's difficult to sometimes get consent for that, especially if, you know, it might be hard for patients to say no if they've already said yes to allowing you to operate on them. They obviously trust you with their body, so why wouldn't they trust you with your images? But it's not always clear that patients know what you're going to do with their images, you know, because there's a lot of ways you can post things on social media that really, you know, that context determines a lot of the meaning. A post on Twitter versus a post on Snapchat versus a post on TikTok, they can have different meanings. If it's the same image, you can change the hashtag or, you know, what song you might play, and it can completely change the meaning. And so the patient might not know, you know, they may not want it to have it posted on TikTok, right? Or with a certain hashtag. And so it's just very difficult. But I think it's important to get consent and to talk about the ways in which you want to use their images. I think that's a, you know, important thing, just to think about, you know, just showing respect for your patient and allowing them to kind of be a part of the production of whatever images that you use. You know, we in plastic surgery have access. We do such cool stuff, right? We're just so lucky to do what we get to do. And we're so used to seeing, you know, patients' bodies and transforming patients' bodies. And that, so I think a lot of us want to show those types of things because they're just really, they're exciting. But that also can be a way of objectifying patients in a way that they may not want to be showcased in that way. Some patients actually do, and so those are the patients you want to interact that you know want to, you know, allow them to be a part of that. But not everyone does, and so that consent thing I think is important.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a fine line when, you know, we'll have a patient that sends me a photo, or I mean, I've seen patients that are. Recently, I saw a patient post a photo of her on a beach trip, and I said, "You look so great. Can we share this, or would you like to take a picture without your face showing?" You know, and she said, "No, you can use this one. I love it." But I mean, I think the key is you always have to make sure that even if that patient signed a photo release, I think it's always good to double and triple check and go back because you know, I don't know if. I know you can talk a little more about this. There are legal aspects to breaking ethics codes or to towing the line, you know, or as you said, Christian, kind of, you know, using their consent out of context.
I that's so true. You have to obtain consent. It has to be unique. And they have to be able to understand that once things are out on the internet, anybody else is going to be able to manipulate them. And to what you alluded to with that patient who shared her own photo, she shared it, but for you to share it legally, you do have to obtain consent because otherwise it is a HIPAA violation, even though she put it out there. She has to give you permission to say, oh yeah, go ahead and tell the rest of the world. And so I think that's something that sometimes we don't fully grasp.
When you talk, and I know you just gave a really outstanding talk at our association meeting about the legal aspect of things. You know, do you have any case in points where you've seen people, you know, not realize something got them into some legal situations they wish they hadn't been in?
Well, I think the biggest way that people break the law is through a HIPAA violation. And what we have to remember is there are 18 identifiers in HIPAA. And so even in the legal cases that have been decided where physicians or healthcare personnel have been sanctioned either on a legal basis or by their state medical boards, it's because that even if they didn't reveal the patient name, they did reveal enough about the scenario that somebody could have identified the patient. And that's where we probably are guilty, because we may not take the time to blur out identifying information on our patients. Or when we tell a story, our stories may be too specific of this wonderful lady had this many kids and does this, that, and the other. And those are areas where if we don't have consent, we are violating the patient's privacy.
I think that's really interesting, because I actually had a patient tell me once, like, I don't know if you should say on what day you're operating and how many kids someone has, because they might have told their friends, you know, because very often I'll say, you know, this 45-year-old mother of two, but you don't realize with people how much is too much. Whereas some people, you know, they wouldn't mind if they, you know, you read their whole history. But, you know, is there sort of a legal defining line, or is that just the hard, I mean, is that where we get in the gray areas again?
That's probably where we get in the gray area. I mean, if you have to have your patient consent, and if your patient's aware, I think you're covered, but I'm not an attorney. But I know that lawyers have said that you have to remember there are 18 identifiers, and so you have to be careful about that. And there are, like, the cases I'm referring to have been cases, you know, like where the most prominent case was in around 2010 or 2011, somebody posted a picture from after a trauma in an ER. And the reason that person ended up getting sanctioned by the medical board was they revealed enough data or information about that trauma that it was obvious who it was. And when we are telling our stories, we're talking about our patients, but we also have to remember the city we live in. I live in Oklahoma City, which is a relatively small city. Even though it's big, it's a small world, and everybody knows everybody. Like, I'll do surgery on a patient at my office-based operating room that's cosmetic, and one of the nurses at the hospital will say, oh, you're operating on so-and-so's mom today. And I'm like, how did you know?
Right.
So
the tattoo on her left shoulder. Yeah. Right.
So I think you have to be careful about where you live too. And like what you said, you may not want to talk about certain patients on the day of your surgery. And just even if they've given you permission to use their photos, space them out and do it far away so that it's not clearly identified.
And Christian, do you work in a university setting, and obviously with a different population, you know, the predominantly pediatric population, do you have any extra codes you have to sort of adhere to or guidelines set forth by university?
Yeah, in fact, the University of Michigan has a very strict social media use policy where if a patient's in a photo, even if you can't see them at all, just if they're in the room or they're in the operating room and you try to post something from the operating room where it's just sort of you standing and it says, oh, here at Michigan, we love microsurgery or whatever, and you can't even see any identifying things, the policy is that you have to get permission to use those photos. And it's a very special consent form. So they make it very explicit about using anything. So they make it very restrictive. In fact, I'm actually giving grand rounds tomorrow at the University of Michigan to the Department of General Surgery, because a lot of the residents post stuff that is violating their own policy because they don't realize it's so much stricter than what you would normally think. It's so much stricter than HIPAA. And so it's important. I always tell people it's really important to know, you know, if you're not in solo private practice and you are, you know, working in another institution, it's really important to know your institutional policies, because a lot of the attorneys have crafted things that are very protective. And so you need to make sure you know what those policies are.
I have to say that I was very happy you guys were able to post when you separated the conjoined twins. I thought that was really special and wonderful to see your whole team do that. But I can only imagine probably how strict it is for you to post.
Yeah, that's right. You know, those parents, I mean, I think they knew they were in it from the very beginning, but they worked right alongside our media team. So that was a pretty special thing. But basically, and only things that were sort of cleared by the media team, you know, with the parents being involved, was allowed to be posted. And of course, we didn't post anything for a very long time. So yeah, I mean, they're a big institution like that, which a lot of, you know, people may or may not be involved in. They have a lot of other requirements. So
I think it's also you're in a unique situation when you're dealing with children under the age of 18.
Yeah.
In your situation, your patients can't give consent. It's their parents. And who knows what they would hope to do in 18 years or whether they would object. You don't.
Yeah. We actually wrote a little piece for the PRS just saying the title was It's Time for a Consensus, because we don't really have a consensus on the use of images of children. I mean, we get their parental permission, but one of the things we want to do is promote the kids, you know, growing autonomy about in control of their own body and their images. And that's a big thing in doing surgery on kids, is trying to involve them in the process of, so that they can give assent to what's happening to them. And, you know, because we lose control of images once they get posted on social media, what does that mean for a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old, and what point should they actually be involved in the process of doing that? And then, you know, there's the whole thing of, you know, going on medical mission trips and posting those photos and the kind of the poverty porn aspect and that sort of thing. Look how great I am. And that, I think that's a little bit different can of worms, but that's also something that you see sometimes posted in the realm of what I do, cleft care, that sort of thing.
That's really fascinating. I hadn't thought of it kind of, you know, in that realm, and especially in the realm of doing the mission trips. I mean, that, you know, I think for the people who are listening that aren't plastic surgeons, you know, and both you guys having sat on the committee, I think people are fascinated to know what happens if you do see something unethical or you see something in social media. And, you know, not everybody is going to be maybe as responsive as the surgeon you reached out to, and it doesn't get taken down, you know, and you're getting more than one complaint. Like, what are the steps that a surgeon goes through with ASPS in terms of, you know, ramifications for unethical behavior?
What happens? So say if somebody complains or reports a violation, typically it'll go to the chair of the committee first. And the chair of the committee may approach it one-on-one. If it's not a huge violation, but it's something that's questionable, or if it's clear, like, you know, with advertising, oh, I'm the best plastic surgeon in the world, and you clearly know that's a clear violation. A lot of times, some surgeons may be unaware of things, and you can call them and talk to them, and they'll take it down. The next step is typically if they don't respond to that first step, then it goes to the committee, and a member of the committee will investigate it and present it to the whole committee, and then the whole committee makes the decision and notifies the member. At least that's the way we did it when I was chair.
Yeah, again, most people, I mean, we it's a collegial process. You know, some folks sort of dig their heels in and say that, you know, no, they really think they're in the right, and they don't respond positively to the feedback that they get from the ethics committee. And in some of those cases, then it gets referred to the judicial council, which is sort of the next level above the ethics committee, and then they will determine if they feel that the member did indeed, participate in an ethics violation, then that member can get sanctioned all the way up to being kicked out of the ASPS.
Attract new patients on plasticsurgery.org with a Connect Premium account. Introduce yourself to 10 million visitors with an enhanced Find a Surgeon profile. Engage with visitors on the patient message boards. Add your before and after photos. Offer discounts unique to your practice. And take advantage of SEO-friendly links to your website. Get up to 5 times more consultation requests than non-Connect profiles. Sign up at plasticsurgery.org/getconnect.
And I don't think people realize that that's a huge sanction for us, and that's at least for the
yeah, it's a big deal. It's not done lightly. I would say that I think, you know, again, we don't try to be punitive in this. But I think one of the things about, again, as I sort of mentioned, as ASPS, as a professional society, part of what it does is defining who gets to be in the group and who is out of the group, and holding each other accountable to these, ethical principles that we're all supposed to abide by. And, you know, part of that is just kind of making sure that we're holding ourselves, holding one another accountable to the to these high ideals, you know, and the, with the goal of like the, you know, patients being first and the, you know, are having ASPS members, patients having the best outcomes and the safest outcomes and all those things. And this is all just a part of that. And so, you know, sometimes people don't want to be a part of that and they'll resign before it gets that far. Or if they feel they just don't agree with that kind of higher standard that we hold ourselves to.
And, you know, I'm going to maybe spice it up a little bit here and say, you know, this shows we are holding ourselves to standards and we are governed by, you know, societies and committees larger than ourselves that govern us. But I think particularly for those in private practice, those solo practitioners, you know, the hard part is ethically who's governing some of what the general public and the patients put on there, and particularly maybe not directly on social media, but online in general. So, you know, and I just did a whole podcast on negative reviews, and it can be heartbreaking that, you know, somebody can write something, you know, and we have to be so careful in our wording and our responses. And, you know, sometimes we say as doctors, gosh, we're holding ourselves to these standards, and Joe Public can go write like some of the most awful things, and there's not a big recourse there.
Unfortunately, that's true. And when I talked to the doctor's company about this 2 or 3 years ago when I was on the social media task force, they said the most common way that doctors get themselves into trouble with social media is when they respond to negative online reviews, and in their responses, they violate patient privacy and they disclose too much information. And that is the biggest way we get dinged, to be honest. So what you're saying is absolutely true. The patient can write a horrific review about us, but we cannot go on there and partake or engage. And that takes a lot of insight or growth to understand that we're better off giving a generic response and then reaching out to the patient on a personal level by your patient coordinator or whomever, calling that patient and dealing with it offline.
Can you ethically acknowledge that this patient is your patient? When I did the negative review podcast, the consensus was that if somebody puts it out there, I was treated by Dr. X, then Dr. X can respond that, yes, I know this person, but I had been under the impression that ethically and under HIPAA, we're not supposed to.
I believe that we're not supposed to, but my recommendation would be if any physician is in that position, that they talk to their malpractice carrier. For example, the doctor's company will give you a response that they support, which basically is along the lines of, I'm sorry that you had a negative experience. Please contact us at this, you know, and we'll be happy to see to remedy the situation or something like that. But they give you what you can write. And then, like I said, it's best that you take the rest of the conversation offline.
Yeah, I just think about what Michelle Obama said, right? When they go low, you go high.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
don't get down in the dirt with them. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to get trapped by trying to argue in those formats, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the beautiful things of social media, unlike, you know, like say a Yelp or something, is that you do have a little more control as the doctor, and you have a little bit of control as to, you know, if you get like a crazy response, that you can delete it. And people know that. They know that you can do this. You know, and sometimes that's just not seeing it, I think, can be the best way to deal with it.
I think that's fantastic. And, you know, going to what you said about not realizing you can do it, I didn't realize it until a millennial who went to high school with one of my sons told me, because she works as a social media consultant, and she said the best thing is if you have a comment or a troll or anything on your page that you don't like, delete it. It's your page.
It's so true. Yep. Here we are holding ourselves up, and then you have, you know, again, Joe Public or Joan Public. Somebody wants to write something crazy. You're like, who's this person? I think that's really great advice. One other topic. Tell me your thoughts ethically about like influencers and people that you know are clearly kind of trading services and, you know, promoting in exchange for procedure type deals.
Well, there are clear laws against or regarding that. I mean, so you have our code of ethics, which states that if you do a paid advertisement, for example, it has to be known as a paid ad. But the Federal Trade Commission has a law, or legally, for example, if you have a influencer who comes to you and says, I want free breast dog, and I will promote your practice. A influencer has to say that they receive this breast augmentation for free, and then they can promote it, right? But they have to clearly state that they what their discount was when they promote it. And that's supposed to be like a disclosure, like we have conflicts of disclosure. And that's the legal concept. In our code of ethics, it does state that you cannot trade surgical procedures for promotions, if I am not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. It's what it says is that, and what's tricky is how we interpret it. There basically there's two parts of the code of ethics. One says that a patient cannot give a testimonial if that patient's testimony, if that patient has been compensated in some way by the ASPS member. So that's one thing. So the question is, what does it mean when someone posts a picture of themselves in a bikini pic and then says hashtag Dr. Burke or Body by Burke or whatever, and if you give that patient free product for doing that, then you've in some way compensated them. If they disclose that as an advertisement, then it might be okay, because another part of the code that says that if something is a paid advertisement, it needs to be disclosed as such. One of the great things about social media and one of the things that make it so compelling is that people do post their post-op selfies and they might tag you, and that's a very authentic endorsement, right? And so when someone's using social media and they encounter that post, they take it as an authentic endorsement. Wow, this person really had a great result. And who's their plastic surgeon? Wow, that's amazing. I should see that. But if it's a paid advertisement, then that's defrauding the public. You know, it's deceiving the public and the social media user. And so, again, as Anu said, I mean, we can put the link to the FTC guidelines, you know, in the podcast, but it's pretty clear. The FTC gave really clear guidelines on this being a violation if that stuff's not very clearly marked as advertisements.
And that just reminded me when you talk about this a little bit, I am sure both of you have seen that show, The Social Dilemma. And, you talk about, there was a point in that show where they talk about, unfortunately, that fake news is often, or false news that is often more compelling and gets way more clicks and way more likes. And I sort of liken that to the patient who, for those of people listening who aren't plastic surgeons, people talk about BBL, Brazilian butt lift, which is essentially fat grafting to the buttock area. And you'll see some doctors post these on-table immediate post-op pictures of these very inflated derrieres. And you know that's not the end result. So, it's not fake advertising, but it's certainly not where that patient is going to wind up, or what somebody should expect from this procedure down the road, but that is what draws people in. And that's, I've seen that topic really been sort of in heated discussion, particularly even when we see those posts at meetings. You know when you're sitting there and going, come on, show me this at 5 years out. No,
yeah.
5 minutes out.
I completely agree. I do believe that showing those on-table results is misleading and has contributed to the unrealistic expectations that many of our patients come with. But that's our own fault for allowing people to get away with showing these on-table results.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that up, Renee, because, I mean, there's one of the part of the Code of Ethics. Again, you asked earlier, are there any specific parts of the Code of Ethics that apply to our social media use? You know, it's a violation to post something that, so specifically the wording is, and I have the Code of Ethics on my desk because I'm getting emails about stuff every day, so I'm always having to reference it. But if something contains photographs, images, or facsimiles of persons before and after receiving services, which uses different lighting, different poses, or different photographic techniques to misrepresent the results achieved by the individual. So that applies to, you know, the on-table result is one thing, but also, you know, there's all kinds of filters that can be used, and everybody knows how to take the most flattering selfie of themselves by changing angles. And we've all seen the photos about, you know, how your double chin looks with one angle versus another. And especially when we're talking about, you know, neck lift or genioplasty results, using different angles can misrepresent the actual result. This is an area that I think actually, it definitely doesn't get in. I think it's violated pretty much all the time, you know, and I think social media is because it's all about how to optimize the photos, that I think it's something that probably no one's really thinking about, but it is a way to get in trouble. And the reason it is, and the reason why it's important, is not just because that Anu and I are downers about everything, but it's because it misrepresents to the public what they should expect, you know, and so it's not fair to our patients and potential future patients to have you know, results misrepresented to them.
Yeah, that's a really hard one to follow. And I mean, you know, speaking on behalf of those of us in private practice that do show on table results, I think one of the, I always try to make a point of saying, here's where things are now, here's where they will be, and trying to show follow-ups in our posts. But I think it's really, you're always towing the line of setting unrealistic expectations, you know, and also towing the line of just honesty in advertising.
Yeah, I think it's really important, Renee, to say what you just said about, you know, being honest and showing your you know, several months out to several years out kind of results, so people can know what to expect. I think, you know, it may seem like that I'm down on social media because I have all the things to say about how it can go wrong. But I think we have a moral imperative as plastic surgeons to be on social media and provide that accurate content that patients need, because there's so many people out there posting nonsense and things that are deceptive that, you know, the public needs to know what it is that plastic surgeons really do and what they should actually expect, and you know, to try to provide accurate information, because this is where people get their information now.
I completely agree.
I think we can't back away from its use, but it's so important that we're doing it, but also doing it, you know, to the high standards that we hold ourselves to, because that's what our patients deserve.
Now, I completely agree with that. We need to be on social media, and we need to be role models for the appropriate way to use social media as board certified plastic surgeons. And by creating higher expectations, it's exactly what you said earlier. When they go low, we need to continue to go higher and set ourselves apart from all the other stuff that's out there.
It's scary because I think what happens is the public starts to see that they look at someone and they'll look at their number of followers and then think, well, that must mean Dr. X or Y is better or knows more. And it's scary because you can buy followers and, you know, kind of creates a little bit of a vicious cycle of where does this end and where are patients getting their information from?
Yeah, it's difficult, right, because patients use so many different proxies for competence. You know, I think all of us expect them to see our diplomas on our walls and to realize that we're the best surgeons because of where we trained and how long we trained and all that sort of thing, and because we're ASPS members and board certified. But again, yeah, they don't necessarily see that as the mark of excellence, and they use that that sort of proxy. I mean, they also look at where your office is located in town, and you know what it looks like when they walk into your building and that sort of thing too. So they use so many different things, and it's not right, but it is the reality that we're up against. That buying followers thing is tough, and I think that's one of the things that I saw early on when I I work with a lot of residents, and they will. And not a day goes by where they don't walk up with their phone held out trying to show me someone's post on social media saying, can you believe this? And it's just because if you post really titillating content, you can get a lot of followers. But they may not be the kind of followers that you want, right? Because you're a bunch of creeps who just want to see your before and afters. And if you post really, you know, sensational stuff, you're going to get more followers. Maybe they're all 14-year-old boys. But that's the sort of thing, though. But you know, if someone's just looking at number of followers, that can, you know, as we all know, that's not correlated with excellence. But it's just one of those things where we have to try to fight that disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I was approached by a program director. This was a couple years back at one of our meetings that I know very well, and we were just talking about social media. He pulled up. At the time, one of the residents' social medias, it was a female resident, and, you know, and very attractive young woman. And, you know, in she herself posing in, you know, various smaller outfits or swimsuits or this or that. And he's like, she's got about 10 times the number of followers as our program does, you know. And he said, I'm getting lost myself. As a program director, as someone running this, of where, you know, and Christian, maybe this is great for you, but, you know, where does that line blur, especially for residents trying to build their social media going into private practice? You know, that situation is really, again, towing the line here.
Yeah, it's very tough. I think there's a lot of pressure on residents to build their brand very early. I think it even affects medical students now, for that they work on really building a curated social media presence and try to, you know, almost sycophantically retweet your tweets and that sort of thing, so that you try to get known, even when they're interviewing for your residency. So it's an incredible amount of pressure, I think, that's being placed on, you know, these trainees. Our trainees are very smart people, and I think there's a lot of ways to build your brand and to get followers that doesn't necessarily have to exploit patients or use, your BBL before and afters, right? Those might get a lot of likes, or the patient's bikini selfie. Those things might get a lot of likes on Instagram, but I think, you know, when you think about some of the TikTok video that had the absolute most number of views last year was one of a girl sort of bobbing her head in a really cute way, right? So I don't know if you guys know that one or not, but there's we're a creative group of people. We often say what sets apart plastic surgeons from every other part. From any other kind of surgery, it's because of our creativity and our being innovative. I think that we can think about ways to creatively build our brand that doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, gross or objectify our patients' bodies. And so that's what would be my challenge, is to try to, because I think it's just the reality that there is that pressure to build your brand early, but to try to do it in a creative way that doesn't necessarily violate ethics codes.
Right. I mean, any suggestions for somebody coming out of practice and building their brand? When I interviewed the two female plastic surgeons that run Lipstick and Lipo, Dr. Ashley Amalfi gave me some very good ideas for building a social media brand and saying, you know, I focus on my family, I focus on my neighborhood, and people like that. They like seeing me every day, you know, and I think that sometimes people don't realize that that can be just as interesting or enticing, you know, and a lot less risk. than some of the things we're seeing surgically.
I think the most important thing is to be authentic to who you are and be authentic to yourself. I think when people look at social media and value it, they don't want to see something that's not you. If you're going to follow, if what we're trying to do is build our brand and build our practice, we have to be true to who we are so that we get those patients or those individuals who are attracted to us as people. And so I think it's, you know, for Ashley's population, that works great for her because that is her authentic self, right? For somebody else, it's different. For me, it's different. It's usually about my dogs, my workouts, my quirky approach to life and how we do things. And that's who I am. And my patients appreciate that brand. And so I think that you have to be true to yourself.
Yeah. I think there's a lot that we have covered today that people can really digest and think about, and hopefully gives people some direction in going forward. You know, either if they're trying to build a social media, start social media, if they're currently using social media, just to think twice when we're doing everything. So I think it's been great information. I really appreciate your time, both of you. It's been awesome.
Thank you for having us. It was great.
Yeah, it's been delightful to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Well, I think this is going to wrap up our ASPS University podcast on ethics and social media. And we look forward to seeing everybody next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Enhance Your Practice podcast series brought to you by ASPS University. You can listen to our other episodes on any of the podcast platforms where they are currently available, or you can download recordings directly from ASPS EdNet. New seasons and episodes coming soon on practice management. Please contact ASPS Education with your feedback and suggestions for future podcast topics. Thank you for tuning in.